equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon, Mrs. Carlett and I are here on Equal Time. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. Got a great show coming up for you today. We're going to be focusing in the first part of the show on NOFA Vermont's Winter Conference. It's being held every year in February, as usual, on Saturday and Sunday. But this year it's being held in Burlington. My first guest will be LaDonna Redmond. She's a keynote speaker on Saturday. She's an organic farmer, but in the city of Chicago. She'll talk about how farms in cities can create jobs and provide delicious, nutritious local food. Second guest is John Groveman. He's the water program director of Vermont Yankee. The Public Service Board hasn't considered groundwater issues as they have been reviewing Vermont Yankee's request to extend the reactor's lifetime by 20 years instead of closing it down as scheduled in the year 2012. And, of course, with all the news in the last month about the tritium leaks into the groundwater, then maybe they should be considering these issues. So we'll be talking to him about the motion to intervene in the Public Service Board proceedings that VNRC, Vermont Natural Resources Council, has filed with the Public Service Board. They filed that just yesterday. We'll also be talking with Ken Meter. He is a national expert on local food systems. He visited Vermont in December. We talked to him on this show just before he got on the plane to come out to Vermont for a week-long visit. Now we'll hear his impressions of Vermont's efforts to strengthen its local food systems and how they measure up to the, I think it's 50 or so regions around the country, 45 or 50 regions around the country that he's worked with on local food systems. So a little bit of benchmarking of Vermont's efforts there. I'm really looking forward to chatting with our first guest because it gets me all excited about the highlight of my February, which is NOFA Vermont's Winter Conference. Yes, February has Valentine's Day. It has my birthday this month. It has the birthday of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. But I really enjoy the NOFA Winter Conference. It's a chance to meet dedicated and knowledgeable farmers and homesteaders from around the state and around the region, and to get good perspective from outside the region in the form of the keynote speakers who often come from a little bit further away, as in today's guest, LaDonna Redmond, who will be coming in all the way from Chicago. And of course, the food is always really good there too. The conference is normally held at Vermont Technical College in Randolph, and it's the biggest potluck. I don't remember if they claim it's the biggest potluck in New England or the Northeast, but it's the biggest potluck in quite a ways. And they have so many people bringing potluck dishes that they have two sittings. This year, it's at UVM. There's a lot of renovations going on at Randolph, so we don't have the potluck, but I'm sure we'll have good food, too. I know that NOFA has been working really hard with the University Food Service to produce a meal that's up to NOFA's standards. And there's also, and this will continue this year, the Ice Cream Social. Stratford Organic Ice Cream serves at the end of each day of the conference. Some free ice cream, good range of flavors, vanilla, strawberry, chocolate, maple, mint. So we'll see what they have this year, but it's always a nice way to end the day. Now, I did mention each day of the conference. If you haven't been in a few years, the conference has changed to 2 days. It used to be just one day, just on a Saturday. Now it's on Saturday and Sunday. That allows a few more people to come without needing to expand beyond the existing space they'd been using. Although my experience is that a lot of people just come for both days, as I do. They expect over 1,500 participants this year. Go to the website nofavt.org to find out more about that. We'll put that website on our website, equaltimeradio.com. There's some really interesting workshops. I didn't count them up, but I think there are like 70 or 80 workshops being offered over the 2 days. I'll tell you about some of them at the end of the time with our guest. As NOFA Director Enid Wanacott and Conference Coordinator Olga Bossart Moriarty say, this event is more than an annual conference. It's a celebration of Vermont's agricultural community, and it will leave you refreshed and invigorated for the upcoming season. Well, enough of my gushing. Let's talk to our guest. She's keynote speaker on Saturday, LaDonna Redmond. Redmond and her husband are organic farmers in the heart of Chicago. And more than that, Redmond is president, CEO, and founder of an organization called the Institute for Community Resource Development, which is a nonprofit organization that works on creating and strengthening local food systems in urban communities. It's based in Chicago, Illinois. LaDonna Redmond, welcome to Equal Time.
Hello.
Hello. Are you with us?
I'm with you. How are you?
Wonderful. Good to have you on the air, and thank you for taking time out of caring for your children on a snow day in Chicago.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
But I understand your children have something to do with how you became a farmer.
Absolutely, and I have to kind of correct you a little bit. I wouldn't call myself a farmer. I would call myself an activist. I'm definitely a food justice activist. We have converted vacant lots to urban farm sites, but I'll give you a little bit more detail about that as we go along in the conversation. But I was introduced to the food system as a system through my son, who developed food allergies at about 6 months old.
And what did you do when you found that he had food allergies?
I panicked, of course. I had to do a lot of research because it wasn't just enough for the medical, you know, doctor to just say, oh, avoid the food that he's allergic to, and not really give me an idea of what to do in terms of how to feed him, you know, or where to get the food. So I had to do more research. I had to figure out, one, what kinds of foods would fit into his health profile, something that would make him healthy, and where could I get this food? And my son's allergies were quite extensive. He's allergic to all dairy products, shellfish, peanuts, and eggs. And at that time, about 11 years ago, that was pretty much what comprised any kind of baby food or any kind of processed food that was on the shelves in the center aisles of the store. And I prided myself on being quite intelligent and resourceful, but I know that I didn't know a lot about food until I started to try to find food that didn't have those things in it.
I think it's interesting.
The food system that had gone astray.
Excuse me, LaDonna. I think it's interesting that you mention that those products that your son is allergic to were found in the center aisles of the store. Michael Pollan, who's written quite a bit about rules for finding good food, says shop around the outside aisles of the store where you have fresh produce and fresh dairy products.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you are using a grocery store, those are probably, that's your best bet for health. If you stay around the perimeter, most things in the center of the store are highly processed and filled with all the things that we really want to avoid or at least eat in some limited capacity. But as far as my son was concerned, the center of the store was pretty much poison for him, because if it didn't have peanuts in it, it had eggs or milk or cheese or something like that. And those things just were not going to do in our diet.
And where you live in Chicago, was it an option to shop around the outside aisles of the store and get good, healthy food for your son?
Well, the issue in my community was that we really were isolated from any kind of grocery store shopping experience. Most of the folks in my community leave our neighborhood and travel around to try to find the kind of food that that is even located in the center aisle. In our community, I lived on the west side of Chicago at that time when we first started doing this work, and pretty much the grocery shopping was non-existent. You could run to the corner store for something very quick, but to really get something substantive like dinner on the table, you really would have to travel quite a bit to get to items that were suitable. You know, get some chicken or beef or, you know, lettuce, tomatoes. Even if you wanted a snack like a cup of yogurt, that was not available in my neighborhood.
Hmm. So what was your next move?
Well, I did a couple of things. My background is a community organizer, and I started to talk to other people in my neighborhood about what was going on. It's fairly well known, and just started to ask people, you know, what their shopping experiences were like. You know, where did they grocery shop? And then I got the history on, you know, what happened to the grocery stores in our neighborhood and how people shopped. And then on the other end of that, I started to look around and do more research and find out where, you know, there are other communities that are going through this, or is it just my imagination? And I started to stumble upon, you know, a rather active organic foodie kind of activist group through the Organic Consumers Association. And those folks really politicized me around the issue of organic food production and the importance of making sure that our food system got back on track.
Hmm. And you mentioned allergies to various types of food that your son had: peanuts, eggs, milk, shellfish. Do you think that the GMOs and the pesticides, the genetically modified organisms and the pesticides in conventional food, had something to do with his problems with certain types of food as well?
You know, I have not found any really solid data. I've seen a couple of research reports that have said that GMOs and pesticides, you know, do, you know, aggravate the system of young people. I would tend to agree with it. I would agree with it, but I don't have any science behind it.
Okay,
but the
fair
other
enough.
Part, as a mother, I didn't want to give my baby genetically modified food or anything that had pesticides on it. And as an American, I felt that I should have a choice as to what I wanted to put on my table. And that was one of the big issues that I had when I discovered genetically modified, our food system had been, or our food system is genetically modified, not just our food, but when I discovered that most of the soy in the United States is genetically modified, as well as all of the corn. I felt like, you know, did somebody ask me if that was okay? I mean, who made that unilateral decision that we should change how our food is grown and introduce these things that we don't have any science on? We don't know whether they negatively impact our health or positively impact health. We know nothing about it, but yet it's in our food system and we eat it every day.
It's not even labeled that it's genetically modified, and there's a bill in Congress right now which would require sellers of food to label their food as genetically modified. So if listeners, if you're interested in having a choice over what type of food you are eating when you're buying your food from the store, you can call up Bernie Sanders, Patrick Leahy, Peter Welch, and tell them that you support this bill to have food labeled as to whether it's genetically modified or not.
I would agree with that. I mean, I really felt that part of being in a democracy was having choice. And the choice to have food free from genetically modified organisms is not obvious to the regular consumer. Someone like me who's digging into the food system and finding out all these different things, telling their friends about them and worrying their family, you know, sort of being like the weirdo in the family, if you will, is one thing. But just your average consumer, someone who, you know, has another life and wants to live that life and is entitled to do that, has no idea what a GMO is or that they're eating them and that it could be impacting their lives. So a label, I think, would generate some type of public dialogue about our food system and get citizens more involved in making those kinds of phone calls and writing those kinds of letters and voting with their dollars and their forks.
We're talking with LaDonna Redmond. She is a president, CEO, and founder of the Institute for Community Resource Development in Chicago, and she's a keynote speaker at the NOFA Vermont Winter Conference on Saturday in Burlington. And LaDonna, at the beginning of the show, you said that you weren't a farmer, but I understand that after you did some research into food, you decided to plant your own food so your son could have good food to eat.
Absolutely. And I just, you know, I just respect farming so much. I don't want anybody to think that when they came to Chicago, they would see, you know, acres and acres of of farmland, especially since I'm going to be talking to, you know, about 1,000 organic farmers in the next couple of days. But yes, we decided that the best way to get the healthiest food in my family would be to grow it ourselves. And that came after, again, a lot of research. And what I'm calling research is just reading and talking to people about, you know, well, how can I get the food? Well, I can have this political conversation, but at the end of the day, I have to feed my baby. So where can I get the spinach and the, you know, and the raw almonds and all these different things so that I can actually eat healthy? And we were pretty much shopping at a couple of the, you know, retail stores that sell us healthy lifestyles and products. I used to call them something. I'm not going to call them today, but we would go to that grocery store and things were very expensive. And I remember looking at, I think it was salad mix, and it was in the middle of the summer, and it was like $7 a quarter pound or something like that. It was expensive. And I looked at the lettuce, and it's, you know, not the size of my small finger, my baby finger, my index finger. And I'm thinking, how much does it take, you know, to grow this in my own backyard? And that was the beginning of that conversation with my husband around, you know, why don't we just grow this ourselves? For $7, I can buy I don't know how many packs of seeds and spread them out, and I could have salad mix in a couple of weeks.
Had you had any experience growing your own food before?
I had not. I like flowers, so I had a lot of experience myself. I plant a lot of flowers, and I worked with a community group called the Austin Green Team and helped them convert vacant lots to flower gardens, community gardens. So I had experience with growing, but not necessarily with growing food.
So one of the things that people often think about when they talk about growing food in urban areas is soil contamination. What sort of experience have you had with that?
Well, I haven't had any experience with soil contamination. I think it's always an interesting question when we talk about urban communities and rural communities, and somehow we still have this idea that there's some pristine land between rural and urban communities. And I think we have to begin to understand that when we talk about soil contamination, we don't need to just really point out that in urban communities there may be some lead contamination. We can point out in rural communities that there is contamination through the application of pesticides and fertilizers on the soil that's contaminated the water table. So I think those are some of the questions, not to not answer that question, but to really have it be more of a question of a continuum around soil contamination. Now, on our farm sites, lead contamination or any other soil contamination was simply not an issue. What the places that we grew on, of course, we tested the soil prior to production, but that wasn't an issue on our farm site.
Well, LaDonna Redmond, we have just a minute or so before we're going to let you go and get back to taking care of your kids on this snow day in Chicago. But why don't you tell us quickly about the Institute for Community Resource Development, which you're president and CEO and founder of.
Well, ICRD, or the Institute for Community Resource Development, evolved out of this real desire to create an organization that responded to the needs of community. And our food system work was just one of the areas that we had been working in. We also work to help ex-offenders get opportunities to, you know, change their life, as well as folks who are struggling with substance abuse issues. We help them to get into treatment as opposed to go to jail or be incarcerated. So the urban farm sites became a visual representation of our belief that the resources that come to community should be in the community and not, you know, somewhere in the ivory tower. One of the other projects that we've been working on is an initiative that we call Graffiti and Grub, which is our idea around how to work with the next generation to introduce the idea of healthy lifestyles to them through food. And so we start a conversation with people and use hip-hop as the medium to connect with them.
LaDonna Redmond is president, CEO, and founder of the Institute for Community Resource Development in Chicago. She will be here in Vermont on Saturday as a keynote speaker on the first day of the two-day NOFA Vermont Winter Conference, which is being held this year in Burlington. You can hear a lot more about the Institute for Community Resource Development and what we in a very rural state can learn from urban agriculture in Chicago. LaDonna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to learn more about the conference, then you can go to www.nofavt.org. You can download the whole 28-page program. You can read about the workshops, like beginning with bees, connecting your farm to local schools and communities, growing skills, cooking close to home, home-scale root cellars and crop storage, my weedless garden. That should be interesting. The Perfect Storm, Wholesale Marketing. Also on Saturday, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack will be the special guest. Lots of other workshops. They continue on Sunday. The keynote speaker on Sunday is Jack Laser, the farmer, one of the farmers at Butterworks Farm, really the spokesperson, founder of Butterworks Farm, that provides us with yogurt, beans, flour, and other things grown in Vermont. So that's coming up this Saturday and Sunday. And in just a minute, we'll be talking with Ken Meader, an expert on local food systems who's worked around the country and in other countries. He was here in Vermont in December. He'll give us his impressions of his trip to Vermont and what he saw. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etnayer. Our next guest has been on the show rather recently. He was on the show in December. Ken Meader is a president of the Crossroads Resource Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He was here to speak to the NOFA Direct Marketing Conference, which was held, it was in January. It was just last month. And we also got him to speak in Montpelier about local food systems, and he talked to a whole lot of other people while he was here in Vermont for about a week. Ken Meader, welcome back to Equal Time.
It's good to hear your voice again, Carl.
So, you're back in Minnesota. You were a week in Vermont. You had high expectations for examining the local food system in Vermont. You've looked at local food systems at, is it 45 different regions around the country and internationally?
That's correct, yeah.
What did you find here in Vermont?
Well, you know, it was a very unique opportunity for me because I've been hearing for years about the great work happening in Vermont, but I had never had a chance to go on the ground and meet people. I certainly didn't study the activity and I didn't get the whole picture, but I had a remarkably good chance to get to different parts of the state and see different efforts that are live and working well. I guess what really most impressed me was just how much one can do in a smaller state where the government's more directly accessible, where the distances to travel are not as great, and I think just the whole history of people really settling in and doing town hall meetings, doing kind of local decision making, really thinking about how to make their locale strong is really very rich in Vermont in ways that some of the more expansive stretches of the country just have not gotten close to yet.
So are we as good as we think we are?
I don't know that. I would say that I had an incredibly warm reception from everywhere I was, and I really think, you know, what strikes me is the way people are genuinely excited about what they're doing, are really eager to share with outsiders, really are thinking ahead of the curve on lots of issues. It's really clear that that's very much true in Vermont, and I certainly wouldn't say it's heaven on earth, but certainly things are really in some very advanced places in different sections of the state.
Hmm. Well, tell us of some of the more interesting conversations that you had here in Vermont.
Well, they were all interesting. I guess the week for me started meeting with the farm-to-plate people in Montpelier and really kind of having a chance to look at this kind of statewide assessment that's being done with some legislative funding. And I really can't think of a more advanced sort of set of questions were being raised in a very thorough study that's well-funded, and having the cooperation of state officials to really look in depth at the food system and start thinking very concretely about how can we make this stronger and how do we sort of measure progress towards that. It's a really very sophisticated discussion that's, I think, been much slower to mount in other states just because again, sometimes the politics in a bigger state make things move more slowly. I think also just some of the issues are a little bit more clear because of the 40 years or so of heritage you have in the state of really settling in and doing very strong local work.
And the Farm to Plate is working on developing a statewide food policy or food strategy for the first time in Vermont's history. So we've had a lot of thinking about food, but this is the first time at the state level that people are coming together and saying, where do we want to be going in the next few years? And they've mapped where we are right now in a way that I think other people haven't before.
I think that's true. And just by contrast, I come from Minnesota, of course, and our one legislator I'm working with just announcing he's going to form a legislative caucus on food policy in the state of Minnesota. That's just the first meeting of legislators here to sort of look at food policy. There's no funding yet. There's no sort of sense of clarity in where that would go. But, you know, we're the seventh largest farm state in the country. We're very, agriculture is very important to our state economy. Precisely because of that reason, because we're such a commodity economy, it's been hard for some local officials to really take note of the importance of local foods.
Well, I went to the Farm to Plate local forum. They've had a number of local or regional forums around the state over a 3 or 4 month period ending in January. I went to the one in Montpelier on a very snowy night that had in December that had a lot of people there. And one of the things I thought was interesting was their preliminary figures on the economic development value of food and agriculture. And I don't have my notes with me, but my recollection was that over 20% of the jobs in Vermont, they figured, were from the food and agriculture sector. Do you think people are normally aware of how important these sectors are economically?
Oh, you know, in my experience, average people really don't have much of a clue, but I think that you get a few hints walking through Montpelier where you see that the Ag Department is so close to the state capitol, and there's a room in the capitol for the Agricultural Committee to meet that's set aside for that committee, and there's clearly a heritage in Vermont that understands that connection. In Minnesota, we would say that maybe 40% of our state economy is based on agriculture because the commodities sector's been so strong, but that's also tempered by rising high technology and medical industries here. I think that people are a little bit more easy to grasp that in Vermont, perhaps, than here, but also, if people are challenged with knowing how to make agriculture strong right now, too.
And one of the challenges in making agriculture strong is even though there are a lot of jobs and lots of money in the food and agriculture sectors combined, when you look at any given product that you buy in the store, there's a pretty small fraction of the dollar that you spend on that product that actually gets back to the farmer who grew the original food that went into it. Did you find some initiatives here in Vermont that you were impressed with to increase that percentage?
Well, quite a few. You know, another meeting I had, it wasn't actually in Vermont proper, it was in Keene, New Hampshire, but another meeting that really helped get me to Vermont, in addition to the presentation I made at NOFA's Direct Marketing Conference, was a Northeast Regional Steering Committee for farm-to-school efforts. And that was held in Keene on January 8th. And Dana Hudson and Amy Winston there really pulled an incredible group of people together from several states in New England to think together about how do we do a regional strategy. And the focus there, of course, is on how schools can buy food from local farms. And one of the real victory stories that I encountered in the state, and one of my four favorite stories to tell since I'm back, is the Burlington Public Schools, which has some really big obstacles. They have some, you know, well-off people and families that are thriving, but also about 50% of their students are free and reduced lunch. They're basically lower-income students. And
50%, you said?
Yes.
Of Burlington school students are free and reduced lunches.
Yes, and so that poses pretty significant challenges, and despite that, they've been able to buy food from 21 local farms and some other vendors without really increasing their school food budget much, because they just don't have much room to maneuver to make it larger. But by buying carefully targeted products, by buying things that local farmers can produce inexpensively or that farmers can't sell in the main market, so they're kind of happy to find a new outlet, we're actually finding a way to get some pretty healthy locally sourced foods into the food school lunch program.
Well, that's always a puzzle, isn't it? How to support local farmers, locally grown food, while at the same time keeping prices affordable enough that you can use it in school lunch programs, that low-income people can afford to buy it.
That's true, and I think one really good example of that is this kind of what is being called a community-supported bread connection that's been made through the schools, where staff of the schools are buying loaves of really high-quality bread every week at a market price, and that purchase subsidizes getting bread more cheaply to the school lunch program, so the students can have high-quality bread in their sandwiches. And it's an incredible example, something that I think Vermonters are better able to do, of thinking outside the box, forming connections that sort of allow them to think creatively and use pools of money to get to local farms without adding to the cost, but also supporting those connections between local farmers, local bakers, local students, local adults, and building a constituency that supports lunch that's really focused on locally produced foods. It's really an amazing set of collaborations that I ran across in Burlington.
So let me make sure I understand this community sort of supported bread correctly.
Sure,
that
yeah.
the schools make a deal with a local baker or bakers to buy X loaves of bread, and out of those loaves of bread, some of them go to the staff at the schools at normal market prices, and then that allows the baker to sell at below market prices bread to the children to be eating in the school cafeteria.
That's correct. And
wow.
And maybe one way I could kind of tell that story is the way that the school district explained it to me, Doug Davis, basically saying that he was looking for a way to connect some more community producers into the school lunch program, and he asked a baker, could you deliver us enough bread to feed all our students? And the price that the school could pay was not high enough. But the baker went and thought about it for a week or so and came back to the school and said, you know, if you could get 2,000 more loaves of bread a year, I could afford to sell you at that price. And what the school discovered was that if they had 100 school staff buy a loaf of bread each for 20 weeks of the year, that would be 2,000 loaves, and that would help subsidize the whole program.
Wow, and it's no extra cost to the school staff, who probably would be buying their bread at market price somewhere else anyway.
They probably would be, and some of them, of course, are using that bread as an educational vehicle, because they take it to their classes and they show the kids what the bread is like, and I think they're also, you know, taking home to feed their families too.
Hmm. Well, we can get pretty pleased about all the innovative solutions that Vermonters have come up with for strengthening local food systems and making sure that people, even kids in schools, are fed good food. What, you know, compared with other regions that you've worked with, Ken Meter, president of the Crossroads Resource Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, what would you say that Vermont could be doing that we aren't doing right now?
Oh, you know, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question, because I don't think I was there long enough. I think the biggest concern I came away with was that I think there's a sort of hope that Vermont can really be modeling this for the rest of the country, and I think that's definitely true. But I also know that from discussions I have in Washington with people at USDA and elsewhere, that there's a tendency to say that a state as small as Vermont doesn't serve as a model for states like California or, say, Missouri, just because it's a small, very special place with unique conditions and has this incredible social connectivity already. And other states may be perceived as having more power or more influence, more money to spend on food, and resources may go to the larger states simply because of political inertia or where the votes are or where the powerful Congress people are. But
so we could get bigger is your answer?
Well, no, that's not my answer at all.
Okay.
I think that's just a kind of a habit that
right.
a lot of people in Washington have. But it's also clearly true. I just witnessed, I didn't talk with, but I did see Senator Lee, and he's clearly gotten some very good federal grants to help Vermont think about local foods and think about dairy policy. So there's clearly a good pipeline to have some assistance for what you're doing, and it will be of a national model, but I think that creating a sense that a small state can really influence the rest of the country will take some pretty intricate maneuvering and careful thinking about how to strategize to make that case the most compelling as possible.
Well, the U.S. Senate is an unrepresentative, undemocratic body, and when a small state like Vermont has, maybe the third most senior out of 100 senators, it can serve us pretty well.
Very well, yes. Yeah. I think another next step that I can envision, which I've talked with some of my colleagues in Vermont about, is that I think that you know, I could certainly see myself coming back to Vermont to help kind of make the case that to local officials that really local foods is a great strategy for promoting local economic development and indeed our national recovery from the recession we're in. And I hope I can come back and work with local officials and some of the great food groups I met to sort of make that case, but also see it implemented in the next few years.
Well, if that works out, Ken Meador, we'd love to have you on the show again to hear what you find when you do your detailed study of the Vermont food system or some portion thereof.
I would enjoy that, Carol.
Okay. Thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Ken Meador is a president of the Crossroads Resource Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. In just a minute, we'll be talking with John Groveman. He is Vermont Natural Resources Council's Water Program Director and their general counsel. And yesterday, he filed a motion to intervene in the Public Service Board's deliberation over the relicensing of Vermont Yankee because they're polluting the groundwater, which is now a public trust resource in Vermont. We'll hear more from John Groveman about that in just a minute. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettmeyer. Our final story today is about the motion to intervene that VNRC, Vermont Natural Resources Council, filed yesterday in the Vermont Yankee relicensing docket with the Public Service Board. On the phone to talk to us about it is John Groveman. He's their water program director and general counsel. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carl. Happy to be here.
What is a motion to intervene, and why did you file it?
Well, in any process, environmental permitting process in Vermont or relicensing process, if you want to participate formally as a party, you have to ask the court if you can participate, and technically it's called a motion to intervene, which just means to participate as a party in the proceeding. In this case, it's the Vermont Yankee relicensing docket. And we filed it because of all of the information that's come to light about the groundwater contamination from the leaking pipes and the tritium contaminating the groundwater and the Connecticut River. And VNRC has a long history of being involved with water issues, and recently we've been very active on dealing with groundwater protection and in particular fighting to have groundwater declared a public trust resource, and we want to be a party before the PSB so we could raise and address all those issues.
Now, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding has been that the Public Service Board welcomes comments from the general public about issues. Why did you choose to ask to become a party rather than submitting comments as a member of the public on groundwater issues?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Carl. And, you know, you can, and that's interesting thing about the PSB is that in most permitting or licensing proceedings, you can't even comment unless you're a party. At the PSB, you can, but you know, it's my experience that your comments are given a lot more weight if you are a party. Secondly, we may want to do more than comment. We will likely, if our motion is granted, be filing legal briefs that go well beyond just a public comment. And we have a staff scientist with an expert who is an expert in groundwater, and we may want to, if there are hearings on this issue before the PSB, have her be a witness and actually present evidence. So we want to, you know, we want to play a role that's much larger than you know, simply public commenting.
Hmm. Well, what is your assessment of the threat to the public trust of the tritium leaks, groundwater and public trust?
Well, I mean, really, what piqued our interest in this is the statements that have been made by Vermont Yankee officials over the last couple weeks as the tritium contamination has been revealed, and there's a story every single day, it seems, in the paper about the nature of the contamination, the extent of it, and what's causing it, which they don't know yet. But one of the statements that keeps popping up is that as long as we keep the contamination on Vermont Yankee property, you know, everything is okay. And under the public trust doctrine, in our view, it's not okay. That, you know, you cannot the groundwater is held in trust by the state for all Vermonters, and you know, even if the contamination was contained, that's a violation in our view of the public trust, and it didn't seem that anybody was really focusing on that issue and focusing the Public Service Board on that issue. So that's one obvious role for us to play if the PSB grants our motion to intervene.
Yesterday or today, the AP ran a story saying that the health commissioner in Vermont, Wendy Davis, said it's pretty darn likely that if the tritium's in the groundwater, that it's getting into the Connecticut River. It's not just staying underneath the property owned by Vermont Yankee. And Rob Williams, the spokesperson for Vermont Yankee, acknowledged that was surely true. So they're acknowledging that they're not only going polluting the groundwater, but they're polluting the surface waters, which are also a public trust in Vermont.
Yeah, the surface waters have been recognized as public trust waters for some time, and unfortunately, yes, I mean, it's not. Certainly, it would be, the more that we can contain the contamination, obviously, the better. Unfortunately, that does not appear to be the case, either with regard to the Connecticut River or even the reports about they're testing private wells now. But the point is that it would be bad enough if it was Vermont's groundwater being contaminated on site, and this is an important principle that really was confirmed, we believe, by the Vermont legislature in the state of Vermont in 2004 when groundwater was declared a public trust resource. But yeah, I mean, it does unfortunately look like the contamination is going to be more widespread than just the Vermont Yankee site.
Now, how can we trust that the numbers we're getting, bad as they are for Vermont Yankee, how can we trust that they're telling us the full story? I mean, I was at a meeting with Jim Douglas the other day in which he used the L word. He said that we can't have regulated utilities lying to the regulators. They've said a lot of things in the past that haven't been true. Do we know that these data that they're giving us are trustworthy?
Well, you know, of course, we don't know for sure. That's a great point, Carl. And, you know, right now, I mean, the state health department in particular seems to be playing an active role in overseeing the testing. We have been trying to give the state, both the Agency of Natural Resources and the health department, enough room to maneuver to figure out what's going on there. By all accounts, they are at the site every day, not just relying on what Vermont Yankee saying, but, you know, actually being engaged in the testing that's going on. But at some point, we need the state government, the trustees of groundwater, because, as I said, groundwater is basically held in trust for the public, and the state, the managers of the trust, and in this case, it's the groundwater. The state really soon needs to tell us, the public, what is going on, what they have found, what they haven't found, in a more comprehensive way than just the newspaper reports. I think the newspapers are doing a very good job in providing a public service and giving us this information, but we really need the state, because I think it's the state officials that we really need to rely on, not the Vermont Yankee officials, in terms of telling us the extent of the contamination and the damage and what preliminarily is going to be needed to stop it and then clean it up.
There's been a lot of talk of a vote to be taken in the legislature determining whether or not Vermont Yankee would close on schedule in 2012. With these leaks in the groundwater, what's your sense about into the groundwater? What's your sense of a need to close it before it's scheduled to be closed in 2012?
Well, I mean, I think that whatever action that's needed to be taken to stop the contamination, to clean it up and to make sure that whatever contamination has occurred does not get worse, has to be taken. And that could absolutely include shutting down the plant, either, altogether, or at least for a period of time, to allow for the groundwater to be cleaned up. I mean, that's just, logical. We're at a disadvantage until we really have the information, from the state officials. But absolutely, I mean, I think that that's got to be on the table, because in our view, the most important thing are the safety of Vermonters, the health of Vermont's groundwater, and to know that the groundwater is going to be safe and clean in the long run, and it can be cleaned up. So if that means shutting down the plant for any period of time, I mean, that's what will need to be done.
Very quickly, John Groveman, when do you expect to get an answer from the Public Service Board as to whether Vermont Natural Resources Council will be allowed to be a party in the Vermont Yankee hearings?
I really don't have a strong sense. I mean, we're in an odd situation in that the proceedings have been, they were closed, they were actually formally closed, and then at least one party, the New England Grassroots Coalition, filed a motion to reopen the proceedings. Other parties will have a chance to respond to our filing, so it could be a week or so. It's fast, and we hope that the board allows us to intervene.
Look forward to hearing more about this. John Groveman of the Vermont Natural Resources Council, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Carl.
Well, there's lots of talk in the State House. You have a chance to be a party in the Vermont Yankee relicensing. If you want to get your views known, call your senators and representatives to let them know what you think. I'm Carl Ettenayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. Artie Levine produced the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
I've been reading two pieces by authors I respect, and it's hard to believe that the two authors are describing the same world. One says the world needs to mobilize on an unprecedented scale to save civilization. The other focuses on the U.S. and is confident that the current downturn is only temporary. Who's right? James Fallows writes in the January-February issue of The Atlantic that he's been, as he puts it, quote, asking experts around the country whether America is finally going to hell, unquote. Fallows remembers the U.S. being counted as in decline for all his life, since the Soviet Union beat the U.S. in launching the first artificial satellite, Sputnik. In fact, he says, quote, pick a year over the past half century, and I will supply an indicator of what, at the time, seemed a major turning point for the worse. The first oil shocks and gas station lines in peacetime history. The first presidential resignation ever. Assassinations and riots. Failing schools, failing industries, polarized politics, vulgarized culture, polluted air and water, divisive and inconclusive wars. It all seemed so terrible during a period defined, in retrospect, as a time of unquestioned American strength. Unquote. A sense of decline has been part of the North American experience from the beginning of colonial times, argues Fallows. He says Sacvan Berkovich's book, The American Jeremiad, traces this narrative all the way to the beginning of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Quote, indeed, only 6 years after the Arbella brought John Winthrop to Massachusetts, a Congregationalist minister was lamenting the lost golden age of the colony, asking parishioners, are all God's kindnesses forgotten? All your promises forgotten? Unquote. Fallows concludes, well, I'm puzzled about what he concludes. U.S. society is strong and resilient, he says, but the political system is broken and keeps us from tackling our largest problems. Yet without a functioning public sector, the rest of society, he says, can only decline. And the political system's flaws are uncorrectable, quote unquote. But we should carry on and work for the best. Confused? Me too. Lester Brown tackles the question of decline, too, in his book Plan B. The world is changing so fast that each edition is named in its title. The latest is Plan B 4.0. Brown looks at worldwide trends, and everywhere sees signs that civilization has overdrawn its account of the natural resources needed to sustain life. Grain harvests have become chronically short, even though they're boosted by unprecedented irrigation. The aquifers tapped for irrigation are drying up. Where rivers are flowing strongly to provide irrigation, it's often because mountain glaciers are melting. When the glaciers are gone, rivers will slow to a trickle during the dry season. Oil supplies are reaching their limits, as the number of cars in the world approaches 1 billion, and grain is being diverted from food to ethanol fuel. This, and much more, all while climate chaos threatens low-lying areas with flooding and much of the rest of the world with violent storms or drought or both. Overuse of natural resources has palpable consequences. In 2009, Brown points out, the number of hungry people reached over 1 billion. Farmers in India are committing suicide as their wells run dry and they can no longer produce food. The war between herders and farmers competing for the same land in the Darfur region of Sudan has claimed over 300,000 lives. Lester Brown still has hope in the face of this difficult news, but it involves an unprecedented repurposing of industrial resources on a global scale, similar to when the U.S. during World War II used a pinball machine factory to produce armor-piercing shells, retooled a merry-go-round factory to make gun mounts, and stopped producing new cars so that the auto factories could produce machine guns, aircraft, ships, and other materiel. What's needed now, Brown says, is a political will to do the same worldwide, and this time put in a strong rail system, energy efficiency, solar electricity, solar hot water, wind turbines, to control population by closing what he calls the condom gap, and making education available, and many other measures. The Atlantic's James Fallows barely mentions climate change, food scarcity, water shortages, or ever-growing population. It's as if he doesn't realize that civilization rests on a material base of natural resources. Where Fallows and Brown agree is their bafflement about how to get the political system to tackle the hard questions the U.S. and the world are facing. Maybe Brown is right to answer that question the way Paul Hawken did in a commencement address last year. First, we need to decide what needs to be done. Then we do it. And then we ask if it is possible. I'm Carl Ettenayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.